Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years and is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting filmmakers, journalists, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe. In order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save a ginormous 25% off of your order. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Now on with the show.
My name is Stephen King.
The ice is gonna break!
Bedlam! Bedlam!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Welcome to the KingCast. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. Today on the show, we have a special guest who is the star of a new Stephen King TV series. It's now midway through its run, but still a brand new show, MGM Plus's The Institute. He plays Tim Jameson on the show, the night knocker, who his sense of right and wrong and his natural curiosity lead him to get into trouble investigating this strange place where children with supernatural abilities are being used by a quasi-governmental organization to theoretically save the world, but also it uses them up and they are discarded like empty husks. It's a dark show, but it's a fantastic performance from Mr. Ben Barnes. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for answering every single question that you could possibly posit in that introduction. I have nothing left to say.
Oh, you have nothing to say about the show?
But so that was the Institute, ladies and gentlemen.
I mean, fans know you.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Good night. Everybody knows you as Prince Caspian from the Chronicles of Narnia films, from Westworld, from The Punisher and Shadow and Bone. Yeah, Black Mirror. You seem to gravitate toward fantasy and science fiction, and I wonder if that's just a personal interest or just the way the cards have fallen for you as you've taken various gigs over the years.
Well, firstly, nobody knows me from Black Mirror because I don't say anything. I don't say anything in it. I filmed one scene for that show, and then when I watched it, the scene was not there. So it's just a couple of shots of me sitting at a bar and then making out with Salma Hayek, which, honestly, if you told 15-year-old me was going to be my job in the future, I would have not believed you.
Some people take a job because like it's shooting in a location they want to visit and spend time in. I guess if somebody's like, you want to make out with Salma Hayek, that's a good enough reason.
I think the director of that episode even said when I walked onto the set, well, we all know why you're here. I was quite confused. When you're on a Black Mirror set, you feel like you're in some old reality anyway.
I mean, outsiders joke about this, but every actor I talk to says, actually, make out scenes, love scenes, sex scenes, they're the least sexy thing ever. Like, is that your experience?
Yes, somewhat. I think it can vary from job to job. I think especially when you're much younger, it's something that can feel exciting. Because it's new and because you're excited about everything that's happening
on
the set, essentially, and you're trying to build chemistry, and it's very difficult to blur the lines between people. You have these blurred lines between people that you're forming friendships with and you're feeling very close with, and you have this intimacy with them. But I think very quickly that gets dispelled when you realize that there's going to be 40, usually men, in a room holding equipment and usually in some confined space in somewhere where everyone is kind of sweating and trying not to make noise. And it's just deeply, deeply unsexy usually. Mm-hmm.
Some people pay good money for that, Ben.
But in answer to your question about the fantasy and sci-fi and genre of everything, I started off not having a particular vested interest in those genres necessarily more than any other. Although when I was at university, I did have a sort of special interest in, as well as sort of like 18th century literature, I was also like very invested in like children's literature. So I was writing a lot about Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and Philip Pullman and a lot of these kinds of authors who were in the fantasy genre. And then obviously when I got the first ever role I got as a professional actor was Stardust, which was based on a Neil Gaiman novel, and you know, a real fantasy. So I kind of associated getting a job with my first step is to now go and visit the book that this is based on. And actually I've been so fortunate in that context that at least 10 of the jobs that I've done in the last 20 years have been based on beloved writers' works. And so my first step as an actor has often been to mine the book for dialogue and details and references of how other characters talk to you. And my sort of prep as an actor has usually been from a book, and then I can make comparisons with a script and I can note the differences and I can be on set and navigate whether I feel like I'm in the book today or not, like how I felt when I conjured the atmosphere of the book in my brain when I was reading it. And I started to fall in love with that feeling. And I think now, certainly in the last decade, having done a literature degree and kind of just gotten over it with all the Jane Austen of it all, I found myself, I loved it. I loved all that kind of classic literature at the time, but I find myself certainly just for my own joy reading mostly sci-fi and fantasy in the last sort of 10 years. And I thought I wasn't a horror fan, I in terms of movies anyway, but I realize it's a specific genre of horror that is not my cup of tea and makes me feel uncomfortable in the wrong way. And then I kind of found my love of like different types of shows and movies which could be described as horror as well. So actually it did become something that was not only something I do for joy and do for work, but something that sort of has defined my career and life so far. And it's very acute when I go to a comic convention or something like that, and I'm meeting people and we're talking about, they have questions for me about different jobs, and I feel really lucky. And for probably the first time in my life in my 40s, really proud of this resume of sort of fandom type projects, whether it's like you say, Narnia or The Punisher or Westworld or Stardust or whatever it might be. They all fall into this kind of category that people can invest in, and stories that you can tell through allegory, which was the thing I was writing about in my essays at university all those years ago. And so yeah, but it's become really important to me.
We talk a lot about, you know, King's place in that, actually, which is, you know, he's somebody who kind of popularized bringing genre into a real world setting, right? And that's, you know, before The Shining, if you were telling a ghost story, odds are it was in an old broken down manor, you know, it was in some, you know, gothic horror setting. If there was going to be a ghost, it was going to be, you know, some lady in white, you know, going down some cobwebbed hall, right?
And those are exactly the kind of horror stories that I can't stomach.
Right. Oh, interesting.
I don't like feeling creeped out. I don't like, for example, The Shining is something that I can't quite, or Carrie, something like that. Is there things that I can't quite, they make the hairs on the back of my neck tingle in a way that makes me feel like someone's going to make me go skydiving or something that I don't want to do. But I think you're so spot on about bringing those horrifying stories into real world situations. And I think that's why, and I only sort of realized this on my press tour talking about this show, but that's why I think he's probably the most successfully adapted author ever. I could not think of another one that was more successfully adapted than Stephen King, because he can adapt it into so many different genres.
Well, that's the thing, is it, there's a variation. It's not like you can like point at the success of Lord of the Rings or the Harry Potter films or whatever, you know, and go, you know, obviously Harry Potter's made probably more money than everything that King has written combined, and all the adaptations thereof. But like, you know, there isn't the equivalent of you have The Shining, and then you have Stand By Me, and then you have The Shawshank Redemption, and then you have the Salem's Lot miniseries. You have the It miniseries. You have the It movie. It's like there's a kind of this eclectic thing about King's writing that spans, you know, audiences. That he writes. There's some tales for older people, like Insomnia. There's tales for young kids, like Eyes of the Dragon. There's tales for the weirdos out there, like our Dark Tower nerds. Like there's a little something for everybody. And you're right in that there's something about how he writes is, I wouldn't say it's easy to adapt. A lot of people have messed it up, but it's there's something inherently cinematic in how he tells stories, and I think it's all because it's just grounded in character, you know. And that's, you know, something that can tie into your role in the Institute is, you know, your character's a hero, but he's a complicated person. He's got a complicated backstory, you know, and you know he's somebody that would fit well in just a dramatic story, and yet he's thrown into the story about all these psychic kids being held captive by a shady maybe government organization. You know, it's like, you know, I don't know, there's something about it that works and translates well.
And I think that not everyone loves that kind of high fantasy, like the Lord of the Rings stuff. So it wouldn't necessarily feature in everybody's top 20 movies of all time, but most people had have one Stephen King adaptation, and it would probably be a different one for different people. Like, it was so interesting talking about what people's favorite movies and books were, with even with different journalists and stuff, as I went through the press tour on this. It's a wildly disparate in terms of like genre or why they like it even, which is so interesting. But it's, you kind of said it the best out of anyone just now, when you were like, he brings those horrifying allegorical aspects pulls them into the real world. No matter, even if it is like a sort of like dream psychotic clown, it's still visiting kids on a real street.
Yeah, for sure. You relate when you read it or you watch, you know, any of the adaptations, you like you fit in with that group, really. It's like you recognize your friends in that group. You know, Salem's Lot's a perfect example of him doing this, because, you know, this is another thing where he took vampires, you know, kind of out of the gothic, and it was just into some a small town in Maine that was kind of an every town that was filled with horrible rotten. That was a town that was rotten from the core before the vampire showed up, right? And he spends the time to let you know that. You see the mother who's abusing, you know, physically abusing her child. You see, you know, the cheating husband. Like he spends time in the melodrama, I guess, of it. And I don't know, it's just a flavor that I think people take for granted now, because that seems to be the common approach, is like, how do we ground this in a world that people recognize? But that, you know, that wasn't so true then. And I'm very curious, especially with your literary background, like, what do you think of somebody like Stephen King, who when he came out, he was not a critical darling. You know, it took probably a generation of critics before he was, you know, widely considered, you know, a masterpiece
Respectable,
writer.
yeah, even respectable, it was sort of took a while.
But you know, I've always held, like, I'm, you know, I'm a giant Spielberg nerd. Like I put a lot of value in the people that can do art at a high level while also being populist with it. And so I wonder what your thoughts are, you know, on that, considering your background and you know, which maybe has you studying stuff that is, you know, more hoity-toity or thought of as more critical, you know.
Certainly initially, and now I've gone away from that. I try to read a lot of the, like, anyone I meet like on a set I get book recommendations from like 20-year-olds because I've been doing these shows. Like I did the Shadow and Bone show on Netflix, another fancy, or Joe Freeman, who plays the lead in The Institute. I'll take book recommendations from those people because I want to know what's interesting to the generation that's going to be dictating the fabric of society. I'm interested to know what's chiming with them. And then, you know, it's also that I can't think what song it's from, but it's like there's a lyric of read the books your father read. Listen what your mother said, read the books your father read, something like that. And so I think that's a thing too. It's like I get book recommendations from my dad and from young people. And so I tried to read all those things. But yeah, I did read all, I read all the, a lot of the classic stuff and I narrated some of it and all of that. And I do love it. But I, for Stephen King, like I came to it from movies to reading. Like it, you're right. Like even when I was at university 20 something years ago, it wasn't, I don't think anyone mentioned his name the entire time of the course. And I definitely came to novellas and some of those books later, and I haven't read a whole lot. I've probably read a handful based on the ones that I was based on the ones that I was excited about as movies, I think. And it's curious and wonderful to see the genesis from the page to the screen. And the Institute was no different. The Institute was actually a kind of an oddly structured book. It's not really structured like any other story. You spend the first sort of 50 pages with a character in a very quiet way that doesn't seem to be connected to really anything. And then you jump into this novella about the Institute, which doesn't feature the character that's been set up, and then to pull them back together. And it's encouraging. I would love to ask him why he did that. I would love to ask him that. But for me, what it did was it insisted on a certain kind of patience when you're reading it to like, and it puts you in a position of kind of puzzle master to try and figure out why these things might be connected, why those characters might be connected, why it might be interesting to make comparisons between what Tim has been through and what's happening in the Institute. And then of course you, when you film it, you're trying to navigate that connective tissue as well. And also we have to kind of we kind of can't honor it in quite the same way because on a TV show you want all the characters to be in all the episodes. Although I do love it in shows where they go off and, you know, in a show like The Last of Us or something where they go off and do one episode that has nothing to do with the character, the protagonist, and then they come back. I do love that. But this, you know, wasn't quite that. But yeah, I love the way he structures things in an odd way like that. And I think what we did try to honor in the show is encouraging that kind of simmering, slow burn tension where you're wondering why I'm watching this guy be the night warden of this town. Why is he having these patient conversations with this, you know, unhoused woman who seems to be crazy, but actually probably has something more up her sleeve that you know because everyone knows Stephen King. And you know, you have certain expectations, even if it's just something based on Stephen King, you have certain expectations of how you're going to watch something. And so to be forced into that kind of patient watching, I think can be frustrating, but hopefully it's like week, and also the fact that we're releasing it week by week as well, I think it's a lot of people are coming up to me being like, I need to see where this goes.
Well, that brings us to right now, which is by the time this episode of our KingCast airs, the episode where you and Joe Freeman's character Luke come together will finally occur. But I have a little insight for you fellows, if you want. You said you would love to ask Stephen King why he created the story in that way. And I did an interview with him when the Institute came out, and we talked about that. And he compared the Institute to It in the sense, not that there's a ton of similarity except for children in the story between the two, but It was about these lonely characters, right? The losers. all these out there, you know, what is it, seven different outcasts from different walks of life who find strength together. And he said to me, so here was his quote: "I wanted to write about how weak people can be strong. We're each our own island, and at the same time, sometimes we can yell to each other and get together, and there is a sense of community and empathy. I love that. I love when that happens in stories." So he wanted Tim Jameson to be alone, and for the reader to be alone with Tim Jameson for a long time. And then the kids, you know, they have their own little community in the institute, but they're each apart from their families. They're isolated from all the people they know. They're now with strangers. He wanted to create this sense of isolation so that when they came together, it had this sort of fulsome feeling. So
That's
they're hopefully.
brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. That's so cool.
Yeah, he this the book came out, it was 2019, and he it was the beginning of this cycle where he was like, people are drawing a lot of comparisons to real life in my books, and that's not fun anymore. It was too much pandemic and kids disappear. That at the time it was family separation in the United States, separating immigrant families, and he was bringing that up. So here, can I share one more quote from him?
Please.
No, sorry, you only get one
All
per episode,
right.
Briz. That's the limit.
He says, it never works in a homily. If you preach, it sounds saccharine. If you say friends make things better. But when you tell a story, people understand these things because every life is a lonely business and everybody wants a friend. And he said, what are the things that really concern me? The things I care about. I care about friendship. I care about government that's too big and will try to do things where the ends justify the means. I care about defenseless people who try to find a way to defend themselves. And all of those things are in the Institute. And I think all of those things are in the show too. Did you feel that way?
That's such an interesting thing that you just said, because I part of me wishes I'd heard you say that before we started filming, but I'm sort of almost glad that we didn't, because as we were talking about the show and about Tim and about what the point of the show is, all of those exact things kind of came up. And my experience of just reading the book just through osmosis, just those exact topics kind of were like bleeding through. I was thinking about the loneliness of him. And so you can do that visually on screen. The very first shot you see of Tim, you've got this sort of buzzing airport, and he's just static in the middle, looking at his shoes, being pushed into this situation where he's like, nobody else cares about this situation of nobody taking the seat on the plane. I'm going to have to be the one that does it. And in the book, he's actually on the plane already. But I think that was actually our initial plan, was to do it exactly like the book, but we couldn't get the plane at the last minute or something. So we were in the airport, which actually I think is just a more expensive and certainly maybe even more frustrating place for people to be. So it was a good setting, but certainly you get the breath of him being alone. He's in this sort of sad little hotel room. And actually, another example of this, which we talked about which I talked about with Jack Bender, who's the director of the Institute, when he made Mr. Mercedes, which was also obviously a Stephen King show with Brendan Gleeson. That character is a very lonely character. And I said, you set him up beautifully by watching him cook this sad breakfast, by watching him struggle to put his shoes on at the beginning. You know, you get this lonely version of this person. And I said, I would love it if we had this moment of Tim walking at night down the middle of the street, not on the sidewalk, just down the middle of the street, and just stopping in the middle of the street for a second and moving on. And we shot some stuff like that. I don't know how much of it really made it into the show, but I haven't seen the whole thing. But it was really important to me to set up the loneliness of this man, and then to think about, like you said, when Tim and Luke finally come together, actually the things that they do have in common and the things that they're lacking that the other could provide. Tim has needs a sense of purpose, needs to look outside of himself. He's got this, he needs redemption in himself for the shame he's carrying about this mistake that he's made as a policeman about killing this kid. Except in the book, he's not dead. I think he's in a coma. But that if we weren't going to visit him in the actual story, that I think it was sort of cleaner to made it a bigger
Right.
mistake.
Yeah.
But, and then he needs to save a kid basically to redeem himself in his own mind somehow. And then for the Luke character, obviously he's lost his parents and he needs someone that he feels that he can trust that is that has been around, somebody that can be this kind of like paternal figure. And so they're sort of filling up what the other person needs to not feel alone anymore. And then they can come together to hopefully rise against an unchecked system representing government and representing their own agendas that isn't the people's agenda. And I think that that is what a lot of his stories do seem to be about, but it's a very clean allegory in this story, and I think we've, yeah, we've there's definitely a lot of effort been made by Jack Bender and Ben Cavell, who's the showrunner writer, to express those themes through the way that we tell the story, without it being kind of too pretentious. It's obviously still like a scary, fun story about like telepathic kids being like tortured, and how are we going to save them, and will Tim ever get a shotgun or not? But you know, this is you know, we're in deep nerd territory, literary nerd territory now.
But that's why King said he doesn't, it's not for a homily. Like, if you put this in a homily, it would sound unsatisfying. But if you put it in a story where people believe the characters and they believe the experiences, I think everybody knows what it's like to walk down a street alone in the middle of the night. And you feel everybody's in their place, everybody's in their home. And you're just this outsider drifting around. Even if you're not, even if you have a family or a place to be, like, you can occasion, everybody has that sort of lonely feeling at times. And I think
We had
he
this
captured it.
beautiful, beautiful moment actually, which is in the show where I was doing filming the night rounds, and I think it was about 3:30 in the morning, and I was sort of marking the doors, and we had certain businesses and storefronts that had allowed us to, you know, place the kind of key or make the chalk mark and wipe it off, or shine a flashlight in the window in the middle of the night. And the very last night we were shooting it, we had permission to check inside this bakery, and there was a baker baking you know, because they're up incredibly early doing that, and we hadn't seen him while we were setting up the shot. So I said, you know, I was sort of standing just hanging out by the window, and I saw him starting, and so I went over to the director of that episode and said, "There's a baker baking. This is so perfect that in terms of like being the warden of the town." So I said, "I'm gonna go in." So I went in and said, "You know, would you want to be in this show if I just knock on the window and give you a little wave? You just give me a little wave back, like you've seen me before." And so that was just like a real baker that was baking in the town at
that what
about
that
three in the
is?
morning. But it's like so sweet. That wasn't like set up, and it was just very real, and it felt very like, yeah, I don't know. It felt right.
Was this a real town where you were shooting? I guess so, right? Like, where was this?
Yes, we were. Well, the studios were in Halifax, in Canada, and so there's the surrounding forests, and then there were a couple of towns about sort of 40 minutes away that we were
It
shooting.
looks like a nice place to visit, and the red steps, the creek that you're exploring is really
Oh, it's
gorgeous.
beautiful. I always joke that I've spent the last 20 years freezing my ass off in forests in the middle of the night. Like that's basically my job, is to be cold in a forest. Like, if every single job I've ever done, I spend half of it like usually some kind of falling over or scrabbling around in the dirt or something, you know, in a freezing forest.
I
That's
bet when the
definitely my
institute came your way, you're like, great, an institute. Wonderful. No
I totally
trees.
was. Well, as I
And
was
then you're
reading the book, I was getting so fucking frustrated that Tim
Mm-hmm.
wasn't going to kick the door down and get in there. I was like, you know, I kind of been playing villains for 5 or 6 years in a row, and I was like, finally a guy who's like gripping real firm to his moral compass. And I was just like, surely at some point we're going to come back to this character and he's going to kick the doors in and realize what's going on and grab a bunch of kids over his shoulders and run out in slow motion with a kid over each shoulder, and you know, and it just never quite happens quite like that. But
They do give you some heroism. I think this is added to the show. That's unless I'm incorrect and my memory's faulty, but you know, the early episodes where he helps save the life of the convenience store
No,
owner
that's in
who's
the
been
book.
shot. Is that in the book?
That's in the book. Yeah. The
That
De Beer brothers, yeah, no, that is absolutely straight from the book.
I forgot about that, but that's a good moment too. I mean, you get it shows his competence, and you know, he can improvise a way to stanch the blood flow and get the right authorities there, and it just
Tim Jameson can absolutely do that. I found that to be one of the most frustrating scenes I've ever filmed. And when I saw it, I was so relieved that it was actually kind of calm and cool. And Jack, the director, kept saying, "Do try again, but just stay calm." Because I was getting so frustrated because you have this very, I'm sure all of your listeners know by this point from different interviews that the blood on set is very sticky. And then I was working with diapers, Vaseline, and the world's cheapest, stickiest sellotape. That every time I ripped it with sticky blood on my fingers would just stick to itself. And so then I started trying to do it with to rip it with my teeth to leave the other hand free. And I'm trying to smear Vaseline and then put a diaper in and then tape it to a man who was covered in sort of corn syrup, essentially. And it was so frustrating. I could not make this thing stick to this man's bleeding gun wound, whilst delivering dialogue that was like trying to remember number plates and license plate numbers. And I was going crazy. And you know, I was thinking, never work with animals or kids. Never work with sticky tape and Vaseline and
But you have to act
sticky
while
blood.
doing a complicated physical task. Like
Right,
it's
exactly. I remember I did an audition actually. I've never told this story, but I did an audition when they revamped the they saw every single actor in Hollywood for when they revamped the Bourne series. I think they did it with Jeremy Renner. That's right. But I remember rehearsing the scenes, and then I drove onto the lot of the studio. And when I went into the room, there was a big table with all these executives and people. And so that's already a situation where you're never quite sure if it's going to be two people in the room or 10. And I went in, and there was two tables, sort of trestle tables set up with a big black gym bag on each one. And there was books in one of the bags. And they said, "So what we're going to do here, it's going to be fun. We're going to deliver this scene. You're going to read the scene. But while you're doing the scene, you just have to transfer all these books a couple at a time from one bag to the other. So we want to see you sort of busy and in motion." And obviously at this point, I've been acting for, I don't know, 8 years or something. And I've certainly done scenes like that before where you're busy doing something. There's even a sort of distraction technique as an actor where if you're doing something else, it kind of makes everything else feel very natural. And I love that usually. I find something to do when I'm on set, something to fiddle with or something to eat or something during a scene that you can kind of distract yourself with so that
business. They call it business, right?
business, exactly, business, so that the rest of the scene can feel very natural and sit into place. But for some reason, this task of putting books from one gym bag to another was totally and entirely beyond me in this moment. And I could not remember more than three words at a time. And I left that audition and sat in my car. I remember calling my agent in the UK and saying, "I don't think I'm a good actor. I don't think I
Oh,
can do
no.
this." Like, I couldn't even move the books from one bag to another. And yeah, I was very close to saying I shouldn't act anymore at that point. I was so demoralized by that experience.
If only they had given you Vaseline and diapers and
That's
sticky blood like that. That's you found your niche there,
my wheelhouse, yeah.
I bet you have an appreciation for Sissy Spacek and Carrie now,
Oh
now
yeah,
that
wow.
or she had to spend the entire last third of that movie just drenched head to toe.
Well, I did do a scene in Guillermo del Toro's Cabinet of Curiosities where I have my in a dream sequence, I have my head sawn off by a witch. And that was an experience to in terms of blood, to like actually have someone trying to saw I had a prosthetic on my neck, which they were like soaring into, and it was actually horrifying. And the blood is like seeping down. I was in like some hospital gown or something. The blood is seeping down your back and your legs, and it just so grim.
You mentioned Jack Bender, he's worked with King on Under the Dome as well as Mr. Mercedes. Did he put you in touch with King at all? Or did you ever have any interest in talking to him? I know you like had interactions with Leigh Bardugo when you did Shadow and Bone, right? Wasn't she sort of
Yes.
a presence on that show?
He was very, very kind of just curious and interested, I think, as you would be if you'd written something we were making on such a big scale. And she visited the set and, oh, who's
Oh,
this?
yeah, that is Nick. Nick,
Cat
like,
interlude.
yeah, cat cameo. Sorry.
Cat cam.
He'll show you his butthole just soon enough, so.
Close up on cat.
And
Leigh
then Brett, no,
Bardugo.
I'm talking about Brez, not the cat.
And these are mine. Yeah, I have them on a coffee
Cool.
cup.
Leigh Bardugo definitely visited set and was interested in the story and had contacted me to say if you ever want to ask anything about the show or the character or anything. And so she was a great sort of champion for the series and somebody that I could contact and say, hey, this line of dialogue in the book, I think it's fantastic. I'm going to try and sandwich it into the show some way, even though it's not in there right now. And she would kind of support me in that. And she's just been very kind and sweet through the whole process of making that show. I haven't ever met Stephen King, but I was very interested in what he thought was important about the show, which you've just told me now, so that's great. But I did know that after he'd seen the first sort of three episodes, I think he then came on board as a producer that he initially wasn't. So that was a real kind of boon for us and a real kind of vote of confidence that I think definitely buoyed everyone through filming the rest of the show.
He's definitely been very supportive of it on socials and stuff too, which isn't. It isn't always that the case. Sometimes he'll be like, "Cool, this is coming out, go see it." And then sometimes he'll like really just remind people, like, and he's been doing that with the Institute. He I don't know if he does it every week, but he's said multiple times on his socials that he's,
It's really cool. And
watching it.
just watching how Jack put together the Mr. Mercedes show in particular
Right.
gave me a lot of confidence about how he puts together stories with, two or three protagonists, but revolving around an incident or something bigger. And it just felt really watchable. And so that gave me a lot of confidence going into the show that it would be handled with care.
Can I ask you something about the craft of a, on your side of things from for an adaptation like this? Because we've talked about how you go back to the source material. That's kind of your thing. You go to the books. I know a lot of actors don't. I've talked to many actors that, say that it's always a distraction because they find out that they are trying to bring something that the filmmakers don't want. If it's not in the script, it doesn't count. I don't like that personally because my thought is, listen, I'm not an actor. I don't have the skill set for it, but if I was, I would want as much ammunition,
You're
as
so
I
right.
could.
It's ammo. It's
Right.
ammo. You don't have to fire it.
Yeah, but just having it there, then if you rolling in a situation where you're just like, oh, this is how we'd react, because there I remember he doesn't like, this kind of coffee, so maybe he smirks when he drink, or whatever. You could have that kind of thing,
You're
but
so right. Yeah, just to have those, I think it's so important for characters to have secrets.
yeah.
And sometimes those secrets is just knowing. Sometimes that secret could just be knowing what the alternative version of this moment might have been. And I just think it makes it more interesting and unpredictable to watch someone, in that way.
And you don't have to use everything. That's the thing,
Yeah,
right? It's
for
like, yeah.
example, a good example of that is in the book. Tim asks the chief for permission to date Wendy, who works at the police station. Now, in the show, we didn't really get into any kind of romance between the two of them. There was just this kind of bond that formed about trust, really, because she seems like someone who doesn't trust and has her walls up. And Tim certainly, it says he's been through a divorce. He's carrying the shame of this of shooting this child, and I think he certainly feels like someone who's not at all ready to be dating anybody. And I like the nuance of that. I like that there's a man who knows he's not ready to get into something with someone and so is like guarded himself. And then a woman who has been through whatever she's been through in her version of her backstory, who is just guarded against new people and is just protective in that way. And watching those two people learn to sort of trust each other. And then there's a little moment of, at one point in the show, of, is there going to be something more to this? And then there isn't. And I think that's really interesting because sometimes that's how it happens in life. But knowing in the book that there's this moment where Tim asks the chief if he can date her, and he says, "Well, you better ask her." And then he does. And then they go on a few dates. And then by the end of the story, they are together. But it doesn't really show their relationship in any way. There's no real tension in it, which is, I think, why they didn't necessarily explore it, because I think relationships are better on screen if they have tension in them. That was my theory about why, anyway. You'd have to ask Jacobed and everyone else why they didn't include it. But I found that to be a really interesting moment of nuance, but just holding in the back of your mind that there is a different sort of metaverse version of this where something else happens is potentially kind of interesting as a secret to hold.
It
I
probably
like
gives
that.
you a little bit of emotional depth too, because you know what your character, you know, kind of intrinsically in that situation, what they would feel towards that person, right? But
And you can ask yourself why. Why are we making this different? And what is important about that? And what can we say with that? And I just a nerd for that kind of stuff. I just love that.
It sounds like the fun of building up your character, and in that it's like the research era for, you know, if you're writing a, you know, a paper, an essay or something. It's like you get that great rush when you find a, you stumble upon something and you know you can grab onto it.
Well, I was also just thinking, as you were describing the baker that you saw, the real life baker on your set, that there's something sometimes very, like, we talk about loneliness as a negative, but sometimes there's something very satisfying about getting up early, being on your own. For me, it's I wake up early and write something odd to hit a deadline early in the day. But there is something about being a little bit by yourself and quiet and that solitude that is rejuvenating. And I felt like you
Absolutely.
gave that to Tim Jameson a bit. And maybe the loss of that romantic connection was okay, because this was a guy who was trying to learn to live with himself.
Absolutely. That's exactly what it felt like it was about. And it's odd you say that, because that's I feel like that's come up for me a lot in the last few weeks about people talking about the importance of alone time, particularly in the morning, you know, morning time away from your phone. I was actually Sam is one of the writer producers on the show, is married to Patty Jenkins, the director, Wonder Woman and Monster. And I was talking to her at the premiere, talking about spending time alone in the morning, reading a book, and just like having that kind of meditative time to yourself. And the like you said, like, loneliness is a very unfortunate thing, but alone time alone is actually probably quite important for all of us at certain, depending on them our makeup in terms of introversion. And but yeah, I'm with you, and
One of
I've certainly always been interested in characters who feel lonely. I don't know why. I don't know what the draw is for me to that, but I'm interested in how lonely characters find ways to connect with people. I think it probably is the connection that I'm interested in, but find ways to overcome that shame, that loneliness, that introversion, I think I'm interested in that.
Well, it's
So.
built in peaks and valleys, is it not? So it's like you have like low lows and high highs whenever you can escape that. Because everybody, even the most, you know, loner of loner people, they do seek some kind of connection, you
And it sort of
know.
means more when you see when you when there's a trust built with between them and someone else, because they don't do it very often.
Yeah, exactly. We talked about, your c characters finally connecting with Luke, the Joe Freeman character, the kid who escapes from the Institute. But you also have an interaction with Mr. Stackhouse, played by Julian, is it pronounced Rikings?
Richings, Richings.
Richings, Julian Richings, who's also a King regular. He was in Kingdom Hospital. What else was he in, Eric, that
Oh, I
we
have no idea, but he is that face where you're like, damn it, this dude's been like.
I think he was also in potentially, I might get this wrong, but I think he was in Stranger Things as well.
Yes, I
Which would
think
be a
so.
fit because this
It
the
has
novel
some of the
definitely does
DNA.
feel like King going, wait a goddamn minute, I kind of started this whole
Yeah,
shop business
absolutely.
with Firestarter, so I'm going to reclaim it a little bit with
It's
this in the
absolutely, yeah.
Stephen King or in the
Well,
Stranger Things era.
interestingly, that's something Steve brought up in our interview
Oh,
back in
no shit.
2019, and he was like, I love Stranger Things, but they are kind of playing in my yard, so I'm gonna go out and reclaim my
Brez,
backyard.
pull up the quote.
So that's a real thing. He was like, okay, but now I'm gonna, I'm not completely ceding this territory to you. But you have a good scene, a really solid scene with him where he comes to confront you about poking around the Institute. And I just wondered if you could walk us through creating that scene because he's such a malevolent character. I don't know what Jul I assume Julian's a very nice gentleman in real life,
He's
but
the sweetest. He's the sweetest man. And what was nice for me was I'd kind of been doing a lot of acting on my own, or a lot of acting with people like Mary, who plays Annie, who are kind of in their own headspace, in their own world, or people that were mistrustful of me. And so to actually have this big sort of 4 or 5 page scene with an actor who is interested in diving into it with me, and it's a sort of confrontation, but both characters think they know things that the other doesn't. Both characters kind of feel that they have an agenda that is not to be made explicit to the other character, but certainly to be hinted at. You're basically both, like in a Western, they're both sort of flashing their coat, showing they've got a gun, but not pulling it out. And I think that that was a fun scene. We had a lot of kind of like, when we were blocking the scene in this, it was originally set in Tim's room in the hotel, but that felt very weird for him to come to the hotel and then for Tim to be like, sure, come on up to my bedroom.
Yeah, too intimate, right? Because it is a poker game between the
It
two of
was
them,
too
right? And so
intimate.
you got to hold your cards back so they wouldn't go to his room.
Absolutely. And then there was this, so in this real hotel, the Stanton Hotel, there was a room off the reception. So I said, why don't we just add a line where I say, is there someone we can talk to the hotel owner and his weird pet dragon? Bedelia. Yeah, so we go into this other room and we set up a lot of 50-50 shots, where you have that kind of confrontation, and then he kind of wants to show he's relaxed, so he sits down, and then I want to show I'm not afraid, so I walk right up over him and sort of loom over him because I'm, a foot taller, and so we're sort of playing this cat and mouse game. And then actually, in reading it, I was worried that Tim was going to come across as a bit too kind of nosy, sort of busybody digging into stuff without having real evidence to keep going. And so I begged Ben and Jack, who very graciously eventually related to me, but my big contribution to the TV version of the story was that in that scene, I talk about Annie's death, and I just say somebody died, and he says, "Well, I think he says something like, "Well, I'm sh sure she did this," or so I'm sure she, and
I
it's
think
this.
what happens is, I don't want to correct you, but he says
Yes,
something
please.
like, he's like, I'd love to talk to the person who aroused these suspicions in you, and you said you can't. She's passed away. Or he mentioned she, I'd love to talk to her. And so that's the little reveal, right? That he thinks he knows
But
who
yeah,
you're
I set
talking
him
to.
up. No, I set him up. I can't remember the exact way it goes, but I set him up in a way, and he said, "Well, I'd love to talk to her," or something like that. So I set him up for this moment of, and I just win. I just make one chess move that actually garners some kind of victory in terms and some little piece of evidence so that I feel spurred on. Because initially in the script, I then just drove off into the forest with no, it felt a bit wild and a bit kind of, but it's also, it's so subtle that you really have to be watching to pick it up, which
Oh, yeah.
you are a watcher in that way, which is so cool. But I was really keen on having that moment, and initially they said no, and then eventually they did say yes, and it made me feel really motivated towards the end of the story without feeling like this kind of Miss Marple's, you know.
I just worry because when he finds out, when you say she's dead, he's like, he kind of knows that he got played, right? He, it was a checkmate moment, and he just
Yes,
goes,
exactly. And
just
I said,
goes,
you can't, she's dead. And then he knows that I know. And so he goes back to the institute and panics, and I go back to Wendy and
Yeah.
formulate a plan. So it was an important little crux moment, which was just, that was, I could only see that we needed that from by the time I kind of got given the last couple of scripts.
Right.
What I like about that confrontation, that showdown between them, is that I feel like these are the two characters in the story who are not pretending with with anyone. They're each one of them, for good or ill, is who they are. Even Sigsbee, you know, she's trying to tell herself and rationalize things and justify things. Stackhouse doesn't really do
No, not at
that.
all.
He doesn't need to. He doesn't. He just, he knows, he feels it's right. He's a true believer, just like Tim
And there's a
Jameson.
self, yeah, you're right. There's a self-awareness. And that was actually the thing where I was putting together this character and looking at the scripts and looking at the book and feeling like there's danger of slipping into an archetype of this kind of Shane-like begrudging savior character. And I was thinking, having played a lot of villains and trying to find ways to make them feel vulnerable or warm or something contrasting with this character, there's a heaviness, but that can be very kind of slow. You know, shame is a difficult thing to carry through every single scene, and it's also can become kind of monotonous. And I was like, what is the other quality that I'm seeing here that I haven't necessarily seen in every small town detective story? And there was a, it struck me that when I was concerning myself with this question of him being a kind of busybody and getting in other people's business, we came up together, Ben and I, with this line about when I see this, I can't help, I know I'm someone who can't help but involve myself. I know that to be true about myself. And it's the thing that got him in trouble and ruined his life and his marriage and all of this stuff that he couldn't help but try to save the day before. And so to have this moment of, I know I shouldn't necessarily, it shouldn't necessarily be on me, but I know that I have a skill set and I know that I have passion and I know that I care and I, you know, I, th there's no ego about it. He's humble about it, but he knows that he's someone who can involve himself beyond where necessary he might, you know, might necessarily be his place. And I thought that was a really interesting quality to bring, like almost like a drug addict, like he can't help but involve himself. And that actually motivated me to be able to get involve myself because he knows he can't help it, which I
Despite the
thought was kind of
risks, which he
interesting.
knows firsthand, you know, can come of this,
Absolutely.
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Ben, we're approaching the end of our time here. I could talk King shit,
Yeah,
institute
this is so
shit,
fun. I
literature
feel
with
like
you all
we could
day.
do this for 5 hours.
Okay, let's do that. We'll do a marathon now on the show. But
We'll
we
do
usually
one of
we
those Shia LaBeouf things where we watch everything you've ever done in a row and
Perfect. But it does occur to me that we didn't ask you the question that we ask pretty much everybody who comes on
Oh.
the show, and that is,
Okay.
what's your Stephen King origin story? Now, we got
Oh,
little
yeah.
hints throughout that you didn't come to King to the written word till later, but you did mention you kind of maybe were knew some of the movies. That's how I came to King. Like I started reading King when I was in sixth grade, so I started early, but I was a movie kid. I watched, so I'd seen Cujo before I'd read it. You know, I'd seen that
Wow,
stuff.
yeah.
So do you have any thing that stands out to you as the thing where either looking back you can go, this is my first King, or the first time you kind of clocked Stephen King as a name and kind of a presence in pop culture?
I think I probably saw The Running Man and Shawshank Redemption around the same time.
What a whiplash of of two
I mean, around
titles.
the same, a
Wow.
similar age, probably
Right.
kind of, 14, 15, something like
Right.
that. And I can chart the genesis of those to all the things that I kind of love about stories in general and scripts and books about, the sort of hope and friendship and struggle and unfairness in Shawshank, and then the kind of unfair. I guess they have some of that fabric between them in terms of falsely accused, people who are kind of under extreme duress. And
But you get
I
the
love
pulpy version on one hand, and then you get
exactly.
the dramatic version on the
The
other
kind
one.
of poetic version, and I love the poetry of Shawshank, and I love the thrill of The Running Man, and I those are the kinds of sci-fis that I love, and then those are the kind of sort of dramas that I love, and then went back to the stories, and then obviously, like, Stand By Me, I think maybe was one around the same time as well, and I think there's probably a realization a couple of years after that that those were all based on things by the same person, which encouraged me to kind of go back to read The Body and to read read some of those books. And I feel like it's such a boring answer, say, like, I love the Shawshank Redemption, but it's just one of the best films ever made, and so
It's a classic. That's why
it's
so many
such a
people say it,
classic. It's
because
such a
it's
classic, and I'm obsessed with those performances. I think Morgan Freeman in that, just the absolute epitome of what it means to be a supportive friend, and that's something that I is really important to me in life, is to be a good friend to people and to support them, and I think that that's a real kind of archetype of the kind of man I want to be, and the kind of goodness I want to express, and that's what I loved about the character of Tim, having played so many kind of untrustworthy characters in a row. This is a man to whom it is important to be a good man, and I love that about Stephen King.
Yeah. Great. Yeah, that's something that pops up every, you can count on villainous preacher or religious zealot in Stephen King's work, and you can count on like friendship being at the core of everything. I think that that's something King values very strongly, and and I'm glad that you picked up on that for sure.
Excellent. And glad you brought it to the screen in the Institute. Thank you for being with us,
Thank
Ben
you, man. Thank
Barnes.
you so much for having me. This was so fun.
Many thanks to Ben Barnes for joining us for this chat. What a delightful man he is, right? He's a charmer, isn't he? I don't think it's very fair that that dude gets to be thoughtful and cool and well-read and also look like a literal prince out of a fairy tale. I had a blast talking with that dude. I wasn't quite sure what that conversation was going to go like, to be honest, but you can always tell when you're talking to an actor who really digs into the source material and has that affect their performance. And when they take it seriously, it makes me like them even more. So maybe we'll get him back on down the line. I'd love to talk to that dude again. And before I let you go, I'm going to give you your friendly reminder that if you like the show and you like what it's putting down, the very best way for you to support it is to become a patron over at patreon.com/thekingcast. You'll get bonus episodes going back 5 years. You'll get instant access to those, and you get new episodes on the reg. So head on over to patreon.com/thekingcast. Throw us a few bucks. We'll make it worth your while. And if you don't have a few bucks and you still want to support the show, then rating and reviewing on iTunes and Spotify and all those places, that helps too. Share with a friend or throw us some money. Those are your two options. All right. Until next time. Adios, folks. The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.